From KXJZ in Sacramento, I'm Jeffrey Callison. International adoption has been in the news this year thanks to some celebrities, but all kinds of people adopt children from overseas. You'll find out how it works and who it's best for today on Insight. Also today, UC Berkeley professor George Lakoff is an expert on political communication. His latest book, Thinking Points, is a guide to framing liberal values for political discussion. Plus, radio personality Dr. Drew, host of Loveline. He gives medical and relationship advice to young people. Dr. Drew visits Sacramento tomorrow. First, the news. From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up, linguist George Lakoff's new book on how to frame political messages. Plus, radio talk show host Dr. Drew. On his show Loveline, he gives health advice to young people. He speaks at Sac State tomorrow. First, adopting children from overseas has been in the news a lot lately, thanks to Angelina Jolie and Madonna. But away from the glare of tabloid TV camera lights, are the thousands of other people every year adopting children from abroad. International or inter-country adoption is a big decision for all concerned. Today in Insight, we'll look at how it works and who it's best for. Holt International is an Oregon-based agency that's facilitated inter-country adoptions for decades. Michelle Johnson is the branch director in Holt's Roseville office. She's a social worker. Michelle, welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
When someone comes to see you about adopting a child from overseas, what's the first question you have for them?
Have they explored all their options?
And what would the other options be?
Domestic adoption, adopting independently, in an independent adoption, or adopting through a government agency.
As well as others. And why would you ask them to explore other options first?
I would want to know as a social worker that they've been provided all of those options and that they are fully prepared for the option that they've chosen.
Does that mean that inter-country adoption should be considered a last resort?
Absolutely not. I treat it the same as a physician would in providing you options for medical treatment. You want to know what your options are, and you want to investigate those options, and you want to be fully informed.
And what kind of people are you looking for? If someone is committed to doing an inter-country adoption, what kind of person are you looking for who probably has the highest chance of success?
Well, that's dependent on the country guidelines. Every country has different eligibility requirements. So the age range of the parent, various requirements that the countries have, it would be completely dependent upon that. So there's no particular parent that I look for. It's really matching the parent to a country program that would accept what they have, their age, their income, the number of children they have, the length of marriage, number of divorces that they've had, and so on.
Mm. Also with us is Gary Gamer, who's president and CEO of Holt International. He joins us from Oregon. Gary, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
How many children from overseas has Holt found homes for in the U.S. last year?
Last year, we placed a little over 850 children with families in the United States, but we also provided support to children who were also able to be placed in other Western countries in Europe and in Australia and places like that as well.
Which countries does Holt work with? And more generally, which countries are U.S. Parents adopting children from?
Well, the largest countries of origin to the United States would be China, and then there's a fairly significant drop-off after that with Russia and Guatemala as well. Those would be the top three. And, of course, Korea historically has been a big country where children have benefited from intercountry adoption. So that would be the fourth largest. And Holt is working in three out of those four countries.
Why is China so far ahead? Is it because of its own enormous population, or are there other factors?
Well, that of course is a part, but China has got two situations really that lead towards children being in need of foreign families. One is the single or two child policy, in which mostly young females are abandoned with the hope that they will be adopted. And that's largely in southern China. And then in northern China, there's a significant number of disabled children that are in orphanages. The abandonment related to the single-child policy isn't as prevalent there. And so those kids are in need of foreign families as well. And these are all families that fill the gap that Chinese families cannot provide for them.
China and Russia are big countries, but Guatemala isn't. Why so many kids from Guatemala?
Well, the adoption out of Guatemala, intercountry adoption out of Guatemala, is a controversial practice. In that country, most of the children that are being placed to the United States are being relinquished usually by moms who have children out of wedlock. And there are attorneys that are working in Guatemala who have got individuals who are out in the countryside or in the cities, and they spot these women and talk to them to see if they're interested in relinquishing their child for a better life in the United States. So, there's quite an active network in Guatemala that identify these women, and as a result, there's a lot of kids placed to the United States that way.
How do you decide which countries you're going to work with?
Well, it's a combination of a number of different factors, but first and foremost, where is the need? And so we have got program developers in our agency that understand the needs of children in these countries. And if there's a way that Holt can help children, then we're there assessing the country and looking to see if we can set up a program that's ethical and in the child's best interest. Keep in mind, we also promote domestic adoption in all of these countries. We place as many children in with families of the birth country of these children. And we also work towards getting kids out of institutions and orphanages back into their communities and birth families if it's in their best interest. So we provide a multiplicity of services to help kids. But we're best known, of course, in the United States for intercountry adoption, and we think we offer a great service for kids and families in that regard.
Are there many countries that won't allow their children to be adopted to parents in the United States or other Western countries?
Yeah, there are. In the Muslim countries, countries with predominantly a Muslim population, they have different procedures that relate towards children, staying within their countries and through the kafala system, being taken in by neighbors and or relatives. There are countries that previously had intercountry adoption programs that were shut down because of scandal and improper services. Cambodia is a country in that regard, and the Romanian government shut off that program due to pressure from the European Union, although we're hopeful that both of those countries will open up again, because there sure are a lot of children that are in need of families, and, domestic families in those countries aren't really filling the gap for those kids.
Are there any countries you want to work with?
Oh, yes. There's many countries that we want to work with.
Will not work with because of some policy or circumstance.
Well, it just depends on what you mean, will not work with. If there is a country where we feel children are in need of adoption, we'll do advocacy within that country to try to get the adoption system so that's working in the best interest of children.
Okay. That's Gary Gamer. He's president and CEO of Holt International, which is an international adoption agency. Also with us is Michelle Johnson. Michelle Johnson, who's branch director of Holt's Sacramento office. I mistakenly said Roseville earlier. Michelle, I realize that you could give a long answer to this, but give us a short answer touching on the main points. What's the process? If someone has decided they want to adopt a child from another country, what do they do?
The initial step would be to submit an application to the agency that they've selected.
Which would be Holt or some other organization.
Exactly. Once they've submitted the application, there's an initial assessment that's completed. Once that has been completed, the next step would be to proceed with the home study investigative process. From application through completion of home study is approximately 60 days. Then, dependent on the country they've chosen, they would proceed with a dossier, which is a packet of documents on that family that is submitted to the country overseas.
And then that would go into the wait time, and the wait time would vary country to country for a child referral, anywhere from 6 to 7 months to 12 months or more. And once they've been referred a child, if they've accepted that child, they would then proceed to travel. And from acceptance of the child to travel could range anywhere from 2 to 4 months. Is pretty typical, or up to 6 months.
And what would be the typical cost for parents doing this?
Internationally, overall cost would be approximately $20,000 to $22,000, including application fee, home study fee, agency fee, travel fee, various expenses, and that's just an estimate, which is very similar to domestic adoption.
What about choice? Do parents who want to adopt children from overseas have the ability to choose what country, what gender, so on?
They certainly have the option to choose what country. However, then it's dependent if they meet that country's eligibility criteria. If they do, countries vary also whether they can choose gender or not. For example, China, 99% of the children are girls. So in China, you would not be able to state a preference. However, some other countries you would.
Do the parents have to travel to the country?
Yes. With the exception of Korea, Korea does give the option of an escort, as well as India.
Gary, how do you and other similar organizations guard against trafficking, child trafficking?
Well, we're very careful about that. We want to make sure that that a child that ends up in a foreign family, or even in a domestic family for that matter, is truly a child that's in need of an adoptive placement. So Holt makes sure that all of its programs, we have our own staff or partner agencies that we have established in those countries, and these are the best agencies of their kind in these countries. And then we're very, very careful about doing the correct background investigations, making sure that there are safeguards against any kind of bribes or anything like that that sometimes is associated with this. So we're extremely careful in that regard, and that's the reason why many families do come to Holt International to adopt, because they're assured that the child that they get has gone through the proper procedures and is really in need of an adoptive family.
Also with us is Kim Dixon, who is a recent adoptive parent of a child from China, and she worked with Holt International, lives in Placerville. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to adopt a child from another country?
I've worked overseas, especially in India, for years, and my heart was really burdened for girls in Asia that have been abandoned. And so with friends who've been adopted, I decided that when it was time, I wanted to have my children adopted from those countries.
Do you have birth children of your own?
No.
Could you tell us about the child you adopted?
Yes. Her name is Gia, and she is 2.5 years old this year, or this month. She was born with a little eye, which is called microophthalmia, and other than that, she was totally healthy. And she was on China's waiting child list, which means she wasn't perfectly healthy or whatever they call that. And we found her picture and her description, and she sounded perfect to us, and so we applied. And we were told that she was ours in April, and we were able to go pick her up in September.
Do we hear Gia in the background?
Yeah, she just woke up from her nap, and she just used her new word, more.
So Gia was, what, about 2.5 when she arrived here?
Yeah, a little short of 2.5.
How aware was she of what had happened?
I'm not sure. She's a classic toddler. She's really brave. She's really smart. And the orphanages, especially with Holt, work really hard to prepare the children that are not, well, I don't know about infants, but the toddlers, for adoption. So she was brought to our room, and they didn't bring her favorite caregivers because that would be too traumatic. But she had been seeing pictures of us for 4 or 5 months, and we were able to write a letter telling her about ourselves. And we sent a care package, and she came to our room with all of the toys we had sent. So I think she was as aware as a 2-year-old could be of what was happening, and she was curious and brave to meet these people who probably brought her new toys.
any sense that this has been traumatic for her?
I marvel at how untraumatic it has been for her. Her first night was the only night that she really expressed any trauma, and that was after playing for hours, and then we put her in her crib. Her caretaker said, put her in her crib at 9, she'll go right to sleep. And once she realized this was for real, she sobbed and sobbed, and I held her in my arms, and she just cried herself to sleep. And that was the only night she did that. And she's just been happy, joyful, curious, stubborn child ever since.
Are you of Asian descent yourself?
No, I'm not. I'm Caucasian, and so is my husband.
How do you plan to handle that, if at all, the fact that she is of Chinese origin and you are not of Asian descent? Do you plan to make that an issue, to talk about it, to keep her connected in some way to where she comes from?
Yeah, we hope to. There's language classes offered when she is 3 in Sacramento that we hope to enroll in this summer, and we're a pretty international family, so we want to bring her back to China and let her see where she came from when she's old enough. And we have art from all over the world, and China is one of those places. We want her to understand cultures of everywhere, including her own.
Michelle, do you work, do you try in any way to persuade parents of a certain ethnic or racial background to adopt children from overseas of the same or similar racial or ethnic background?
No, I don't persuade anyone to choose which country they're adopting from. We have, of course, a lot of Korean Americans that would like to and adopt from Korea. We have a lot of Chinese American couples that choose to and have made the decision to adopt from China. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Well, I think it does. Gary, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, some of the countries actually they allow individuals of the same ethnic or racial origins. They give them some preference, such as India, in terms of how the processing goes. But I concur exactly with what Michelle said. We don't try to steer a particular individual one way or another. Their heart will steer them in the right direction to make the right decision.
What's Holt's position on children from overseas maintaining some kind of connection, cultural, language, whatever, to their country of origin?
We really emphasize that with families. We think that's vitally important for a great upbringing and self-awareness of children. And in that regard, we have camps in the summer that focus on adoption identity and may look at their birth cultures. There's also motherland tours that we sponsor to countries where children are adopted from. And, some of these tours are just adoptees going when they get to be teenagers or young adults, and others occur with families. And we really encourage them to connect up with the cultural institutions and networks that exist in their own community. So we're very strong advocates for that.
What happens if that does not take place?
Well, every child's different, and some kids, don't gravitate in that direction. And I think the worst thing you can do is force feed a child, a particular, cultural identity. You basically have got to listen to, the youngster as they grow up and identify with them and not force anything on them.
Gary, the founders of Holt International were motivated by their religious faith. Is there a religious component to Holt's services, or a religious requirement of the people you work with?
Yeah, Jeffrey, we just celebrated our 50th anniversary just last month. It was a great occasion, and that was when our founders, Harry and Bertha Holt, started adoption in Korea. They were very strong Christians, and it was their Christian identity that led them to do this work, and Holt maintains that Christian identity to this very day. However, as we recruit families and work with partners all around the world, we don't say that you have to be Christian to adopt, and we realize that in order to solve this global crisis of children that are outside of family care, that we need to relate to many different people of many different persuasions and embrace them as long as we, share the very same conviction that children need to be in families.
And have the recent news stories about international adoption involving celebrities helped or hindered the work of agencies like yours that are working with non-celebrities who want to adopt children from overseas?
I think it mostly helps because it raises identity, you know, across the United States and other countries about the needs of kids. You know, if you look at a country like Malawi, I mean, there's just tens of thousands of orphans that, you know, have lost their parents due to AIDS and other maladies, and it just raises that awareness. Of course, there's great debate about whether an adoption like that should occur, but it raises awareness and it gets people thinking, well, could I do that? And is there a door that I could open for a child, either through adoption or maybe even through sponsorship by helping the kids that can't be adopted?
Michelle, is there anyone who you would recommend not adopt children from overseas?
Anyone I would recommend not adopt?
Anyone, a kind of person because of the circumstances or whatever.
Well, if the person didn't fit the eligibility criteria or if they did not successfully complete our assessment, they would not be able to proceed, and I would not. And at that time, I would recommend that they not proceed.
Okay. And finally, Kim, you've adopted one child.
Yes.
Gia, are you going to adopt more? And if so, where from?
We hope to. We'd like to adopt from India next, and after that, who knows?
I see. Very good. Well, thank you all for joining us. I really appreciate it. That's Michelle Johnson, the branch director of Holt International Sacramento office. She's a social worker. Gary Gamer, president and CEO of Holt International in Oregon. And Kim Dixon of Placerville, who's a recent adoptive parent of a child from China. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, UC Berkeley professor George Lakoff is an expert on political communication. His latest book, Thinking Points, is a guide to framing liberal values for political discussion. He also analyzes the thought process of political moderates. We'll be right back. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. The 2008 presidential season is already underway, with well-known politicians already forming so-called exploratory committees. Before you know it, senators, governors, and the like will be actively campaigning in early primary and caucus states. Given the stakes, a presidential election that's unusual for having no incumbent president or vice president running for office, you can be sure both Democrats and Republicans will be working hard on their messages. An expert in the art of framing values is George Lakoff, a professor of linguistics and cognitive science at UC Berkeley. He's well known for his books and his research on how conservatives and liberals think about and express their political values. His new book is Thinking Points, a Progressive's Handbook, Communicating Our American Values and Vision. George Lakoff joins us. George, welcome back to Insight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Your book has an American flag on the cover, and I think it's fair to say that the U.S. flag is much more commonly used on conservative publications. Why is the flag on the front of Thinking Points?
For a very good reason, because traditional American values are progressive values, and progressives need to wave that flag. In fact, they probably ought to wave two of them, because they're more patriotic.
Is that at all controversial among liberals and progressives? Because I'm sure that many liberals and progressives associate the flag with conservative political messages, just as conservatives do.
Well, in some cases it has been, though they've been learning over the past couple of years. Several years ago, let's say right after the 2000 elections. My wife went to a protest rally with a large American flag to protest the election, and she got a lot of criticism for it, and she said, wait a minute, this is my country. You know, I'm proud of it. I want to take it back. You know, that's why I'm waving this flag. And she's right. And I think the Democratic politicians have understood that, and, they're using flags. And I think progressives more and more have understood that, the history of this country is the history of their principles, and that the symbol of the country ought to be their symbol.
Why do progressives need help explaining in a succinct and compelling way their values?
Everybody generally does. in most cases, people's deepest values and deepest feelings are part of what's called the cognitive unconscious. As a cognitive scientist, that's what we understand. It's not, it has nothing to do with Freudianism or anything like that. These are just normal things. Most of your thought, probably 95%, is below the level of consciousness. It's what your brain does that you are not aware of. And that especially includes concepts and values that you're thinking in terms of. In 1964, conservatives, after Goldwater lost, didn't really understand what conservatism was about for them, and they tried to figure it out. And they set up think tanks. They've spent over $4 billion on it in 35 years. And those think tanks very largely figured out, what conservative principles were about and how they linked the various types of conservatives. The same did not happen with progressives. They did not set up appropriate think tanks. They did not, try to figure out what they were about because everybody wanted to be a liberal at that point, and they didn't have to. Now they have to.
Let me back up. We're used to the expression talking points in politics. Why did you call your book Thinking Points?
Well, because people don't understand that framing is about thinking, not just messages. In order for a slogan or a message to work, it has to fit in what I will call a set of deep frames, and they are various kinds. They include a moral worldview, that is, any political argument depends upon a sense of what's right. You argue for what's right, not what's wrong. It requires having various core values understood, like freedom and fairness and so on, but freedom and fairness are contested, and there are progressive and conservative versions of those, and you need to understand what they are. And then there are political principles that are very, very different across conservatives and progressives. And then there are frames that define issues that say what the problem is and what a solution is and so on. And these are things people just aren't aware of. They don't know that this is happening to them. They just, they're there. Conservatives have been made aware of them by people like Frank Luntz, who have put out training manuals and, done long trainings. Progressives have not been made aware of how their own minds work. And therefore, they have not gotten out in public the values, the core principles, the worldview that's behind what they believe. And until they do that, they're not going to be able to get out messages and slogans that are effective. So they need thinking points before they need talking points.
Well, the subtitle of your book, Thinking Points, is a progressive's handbook, which suggests that you see it as a training manual.
Yes, we do. And here at the Rock Ridge Institute, that's part of what we're about. We've spent the last 4 years as an institute dedicated to providing intellectual services to the progressive community. The very first job we had to do was figure out exactly how framing worked, how it worked at every level, at the level of argument, at the level of values, at the level of worldviews, at the level of issue-defining frames. We had to work out the whole thing. 2 years ago, we had figured out about half of it, and I put out a book called Don't Think of an Elephant that went through a lot of what I call surface framing. But in the last 2 years, we've done pretty much most of the rest, and I think we've got it pretty much down in terms of the basics. Now we have to work it out for the full range of issues and future issues, not just the present ones. And then we've got to get it out there. This is not something that the elected leaders in Washington are going to be using and so on, because they have to follow what their consultants, and they have a whole consultant class, what their consultants say. This is something for the grassroots. This is why you need a serious grassroots progressive movement that unites people. Rockridge is going to now open up for a computerized community out there on the web starting in January to try to get a million voice network of progressives who want to speak out on these issues and want to know exactly what their values are, what their principles are, and so on, and want a place where they can discuss this openly and debate it and make suggestions and criticize it and so on. But that's what we're going to do. And the other thing we want to do is train journalists. Journalists have been accepting conservative framings for years without even knowing that they're doing it. Even liberal journalists accept conservative framings. And it's time that journalists be trained in how framing works. So that's another part of what we're about.
Okay. When you're watching TV or listening to the radio or reading the newspaper, are there common things that you hear or see liberals or progressives saying that just make you cringe?
Constantly. Let me give you the latest. On election night last week, Rahm Emanuel got up there and talked about how the country had moved to the center and the vital center and how all these moderates had gotten elected. And the word moderate keeps being used over and over and over. When you study it, it turns out that there is no worldview that's moderate. There's no single ideology of moderateness. There is no single set of principles that define a center. It doesn't exist. What exists is something very different, what I call biconceptualism. That is, it's very common for people to have both progressive views and conservative views about different areas of life. So there, Ronald Reagan understood this very well. He understood that blue-collar workers were basically strict fathers, conservative strict fathers at home, and sort of nurturing progressives in their union workplaces. So he used metaphors for the home to talk about politics and get them to vote for him. There are plenty of people who are, let's say, conservative about foreign policy and progressive about domestic policy or some other combination of these things. And what we have found is, in fact, that there are a lot of people who will call themselves conservatives but who are actually progressives in many parts of their lives. So throughout the Midwest, and I lived there for some time, what I found was that Midwesterners and people who live in the far West love the land as much as any environmentalist, but they would never use words like biodiversity. They just, love the land, want to fish and eat their fish and hunt and take their kids camping and breathe clean air and drink clean water. And the same is true of progressive Christians who may call themselves conservatives but really believe that you should be a good steward of the earth and the poor should be fed and the sick should be healed and so on. And if you go through this, you find lots of that. Now, what happened in the election was really interesting because a lot of the Democrats who were called moderates actually ran completely on progressive platforms, but happened to have some views that were conservative. So a very good example would be someone like Heath Shuler, who, he came on an NPR program last week and said, look, the interviewer said, look, you're against gay marriage, you're against abortion, you're for owning guns. What makes you a Democrat? And he said, look, those are just conditions of life in my district. I'm a Democrat because I was raised by my parents to believe that Democrats help people who need help. That's why we need to protect Social Security. That's why we need to raise the minimum wage, and so on. And he went through a long list of progressive positions, which is where his heart of heart is. That is, he identifies himself with progressive ideas, and in some cases, he has conservative ideas.
Finally, George, do you know if conservatives have made use of your research either to refine their own message or to better understand the liberal message?
I don't know of any such cases. They may have. If they're smart, they have. But I really don't know.
Okay.
They haven't been telling me.
George Lakoff is the author of Thinking Points, a progressive's handbook communicating our American values and vision. It's his latest book. He's also a UC Berkeley professor of linguistics and cognitive science. George Lakoff, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure as always.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. Coming up, radio personality Dr. Drew, host of Loveline. He gives medical and relationship advice to young people. Dr. Drew visits Sacramento tomorrow. We'll be right back. The Sutter Buttes is a tiny mountain range just north of Sacramento. The buttes have an interesting natural history, but also a little mysterious, in part because most of the land is private and usually not open to the public. Naturalist Walt Anderson is an expert on the Sutter Buttes, and he's written a book about them called Inland Island. I talked recently with Walt Anderson and asked him what he thinks makes the Sutter Buttes special.
You know, the Sacramento Valley is so highly altered by human activities that I think maybe people aren't expecting this. It's off their radar screens. But as many people say, this is a very distinctive, some say the world's smallest mountain.
We went to another topic there because we're waiting for Dr. Drew, and looks like Dr. Drew's going to be with us. You're listening to Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. For over 20 years, the syndicated radio show Loveline has given health and relationship advice to young people. Co-hosts have come and gone, but Dr. Drew has been there from day one. Dr. Drew Pinsky, as his patients would call him, is a real physician. His specialty is addiction. Dr. Drew is in Sacramento tomorrow for an evening talk at the Sac State campus. He joins us by phone. Dr. Drew, welcome to Insight.
Thank you so much.
How did you get started giving health and relationship advice to young people on the radio?
Well, it's a very long and nefarious story, but I'm sure I will tell it at Sac State tomorrow night. The cliff notes are I was living in the early 80s while I was going to medical school near a little radio station that became a dominant force in Los Angeles radio. But at the time, I'd never really barely heard of the station and had friends because we all lived near the station. We're socializing with people that worked there. And a couple of guys realized they spent an awful lot of their time obsessing about relationships and girls, so they went to their program director and said, how about we turn the phones on and let people, you know, converse about this topic? At that time, the program director was looking for an FCC community service show, FCC-mandated community service show, so he said, great, you guys came along right at the right time. Here's your time slot, midnight Sunday night to 3 a.m. Monday morning. Enjoy. And they did it, and phone lines lit up, and there were people calling about things they couldn't handle. And they were having trouble making it a community service show, and somebody suggested that, you know, Pinsky's in medical school, maybe he can help. And they called me, and I had no designs on radio, and I was just John Q., third-year medical student. And there's a long story that ensued, but eventually I was coerced to go up there and was really taken by the fact that here's this amazing material being presented on radio. And you have to really put it that in historical context at the time, too, because, you know, we were still calling AIDS GRIDS, gay-related intestinal disease syndrome, and, you know, condoms were behind the counter, had the pharmacist had to bring them out, the term safe sex hadn't been coined yet. And as a young person, I could really see what was happening, and I thought, you know, this body of information that simply has got to be discussed with young people. I know how they're behaving, and no one is giving them the right information. And I did it for the next 10 years as community service. I thought I was doing community service, and it kind of took over my life.
Did you always call yourself Dr. Drew on air?
I did. I didn't want anybody to know I was doing this. It was just this little sort of, I didn't want to be seen as self-promotional. I didn't want to be, I don't know, it just bothered me that I could be seen, you know, looked at askance. And it was sort of, it was difficult, you know, it was a difficult, I'm not someone to step out of line. And so to begin addressing publicly these topics that really at that point in history weren't being commonly dealt with, it was tough. I mean, I sort of wanted to hide the fact that I was doing it, but I just felt that it was an important thing to do.
Did you ever get into trouble as a regular physician because that was your day job because of what you were doing at night?
I did. When I was in residency, actually, I guess I was an intern at that point, my residency director wasn't too happy with it, and so I stopped. And in about 3-4 months later, the whole AIDS epidemic and the need for public education became, it just broke. And all of a sudden, I went from somebody who was doing something silly to doing something that we were all mandated to do. And was, you know, people were, same guy that was yelling at me about how foolish this was, walked up to me 2 years later. I actually ended up taking a teaching position from the same guy. And he walked up to me 2 years later and said, are you still doing that thing? And by then I had started doing it again because, again, it was highly, you know, pushed on us, something that was desirable to do. And he said, how about I do it now? You've had enough. Yeah, I'll take over. Are you kidding?
My guest is Dr. Drew. He's the co-host of Loveline, a syndicated radio show that focuses on young people, giving advice on health and relationship issues. Do you have a general philosophy about health and sexuality that guides you when you're answering questions from young people?
Well, there's probably multiple layers to that. One is I try diligently not to judge or be pejorative. That isn't to say that I can't call people out on their behavior or be firm with it. I try not to use terminology that would shame. I do try to shape and change their behavior, though. And I try to look, and, you know, I work in mental health, and so I look at all of this as healthy behavior versus unhealthy behavior. And try to advocate on behalf of what's healthy.
What about when someone comes out and specifically asks you for advice on what they should do in a situation that is very difficult?
Well, the radio is not, no, there's no such thing as a media treatment alliance. In other words, these circumstances where people's cases are discussed, whether it's in print or television or radio, should never be thought of as treatment. Never, ever, ever. They can be thought of as, you know, tossing ideas around. They're certainly educational. I mean, when, you know, we go to medical school, we study cases. It's experiential learning. And so very often a relatable source, like another young person having an intense experience, is very powerful in terms of educating the listeners. But in terms of really shaping or changing the behavior of the individual we're talking to, no. And by and large, we're talking to people with very severe, complex medical and mental health issues. And boy, I mean, mostly what I'm saying is get treatment. Treatment works. Get treatment. Go to 12-step meetings, whatever, you know, it might be. Don't think about this as treatment. Just get yourself to treatment.
If a girl or young woman calls you and she's pregnant and she is wondering whether or not to have an abortion, how do you handle that? That's a particularly difficult situation.
It is tough, and fortunately, we don't get much of that, thankfully. What I try to do is refer to resources or support where they can sort this out for themselves. And really, where we first try to send them back to is their family. You know, are your parents aware? Who's helping you through this? How do you gather up the support to make this difficult decision? And what are your resource options in your community? That's it. I try not. I'm actually not strongly, but fairly anti-abortion myself, and I just try to let the law stand and give people resources and help them get what they need to make their own decision.
Everyone who works in broadcasting is familiar with and has had to deal with the changing climate at the FCC, which is much less tolerant nowadays of inappropriate, or what it considers inappropriate, language on the air. Has that changed the way that you handle Loveline?
Periodically, we've tried to be more diligent. You know, I always look for guidelines, and I want to be a good citizen and do what is the powers that be are asking of us. For the most part, I have found that as long as we have a reason, in other words, there's a purpose to the discussions we have. Now, albeit we have celebrities in there every night, and I have a co-host always, and they're kind of goofing around or giving their own opinion. But, you know, I think people appreciate that that's sort of getting the person enrolled to the point where we can have a discussion that young people can hear and try to keep it clinically meaningful. And if there's, you know, the question I always ask myself at the end of every call really is, did we do this for a reason? Was there a purpose for which we went where we went? Did we need to go there, and did we go there for a reason?
Your most famous co-host was Adam Carolla, who was with you for about 10 years, I believe.
Yes.
He was, for part of the time when he was working with you in Loveline, the co-host also of The Man Show on Comedy Central, which was sometimes quite raunchy program. Did you feel that there was any pull from Adam or from any of your co-hosts to make the show more of an entertaining look at issues around sexuality than you as a practicing physician might have wanted it to be.
That is the tightrope walk I must maintain every night, which is it has to be sufficiently entertaining that the people that know how to create media and entertainment can do their job so I get the ears to be able to deliver the information. We, Adam and I used to talk about the Gainsburger and the pill philosophy. That is to say that if you want a dog to take a pill, you can't cram it down its throat very often. You certainly can't hand it the pill, but you wrap it up in Gainsburger and hand it. It takes the pill pretty much every time. So Adam was the Gainsburger, and I proudly was the pill. And as such, that I was willing to sort of trust the people that create entertainment. And yes, there's always that that push and pull. Absolutely.
After Dr. Drew came Dr. Laura and Dr. Phil. What do you think about them?
Laura, I think, does a great job at what she does, and she's a brilliant radio broadcaster, and she, I think, I don't listen to a lot of what she's been doing lately, but I know her, and I know her to be a very passionately caring person about the work she's doing, and she seems to stay more in the philosophical and moralizing context rather than the clinical, so it's something very different than what I'm doing. And Phil and I, again, Phil does a great job at what he does, but I feel very differently about what people need. I think the notion that you can choose to change behavior is a very thin notion. I mean, I deal with drug addicts and alcoholics all day long, and the idea that they could simply choose not to do heroin or choose not to do cocaine is absurd. They would give, they're on their knees begging for what it is they need to be able to stop doing this. People lose their everything, including their lives. They would do anything if they could choose otherwise. They can't. And there are profound limits to our ability to choose behavioral change. It's a very complex topic. And so the whole issue of motivational priorities and how our central nervous systems work and our brains work in regard to that is something I live in every day, and I think it's done a disservice to distill it all down to, well, you just need to realize it's wrong and change it, just, you know, choose otherwise. I think that's doing people a disservice.
What's the most important thing you think the government should do to help cure or to help reduce drug addiction in this country?
Well, boy, you're asking me, you know, all those $30 million questions here, and I think we've learned that the sort of punitive models for dealing and the moralistic models for dealing with addiction really don't work, and that funneling resources more towards therapeutic models do work, and I see treatment work all the time, and as such, I'm a very strong advocate of that. But more importantly, we need to get at the source of all this, you know, where it's coming from. And in my world, the primary issue is the destroyed family systems and the incredible deprivation and abuse that goes on in many family systems. In my program, if you need inpatient chemical dependency treatment, the probability of you having been physically or sexually abused approaches 100%. It is unbelievably common in our culture, or severe deprivation, which is really some of the worst abuse. It's unbelievably common in our culture. It's shocking to me, and it's also shocking how poorly aware, how poor the awareness is, and how poorly understood these phenomena are, such that they can go on generation. They does go on generation to generation. These things are the gift that keep on giving. They destroy people's lives. They increase the probability that they themselves are going to be perpetrators. And if they carry with them the gene for addiction, the addiction almost always blossoms.
And we just have seconds left, Dr. Drew, but I saw a video of you singing an aria from an opera. How did you learn to sing so well?
I trained for many, 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 many years. I spent 5 minutes trying to decide if I wanted to be an opera singer and quickly abandoned that. I'm a horrible musician.
Sounds like you could be, though.
Well, but I'm a good singer, and so I kept the voice going as an avocation. I, you know, haven't trained in years, but love doing it once in a while.
And what's your favorite opera?
It's hard for me. I really like all the Verdi operas. I mean, I'm a spaghetti and meatballs guy.
Very good. Well, Dr. Drew, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Dr. Drew, co-host of Loveline, the radio show that can be heard in Sacramento on 100.5 The Zone and in Reno on 100.9 KRZQ, Sunday through Thursday at 10 p.m. You're listening to Insight. By the way, Dr. Drew is speaking at Sacramento State tomorrow evening. There's more details at capradio.org/insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Coming up in the KXJZ station, suicide bombers have been compared to the Japanese kamikaze pilots of World War II. One historian says that's wrong. Young Japanese didn't volunteer to die. You'll hear some of their letters, kamikaze diaries, and the day's news next on The World. Insight staff includes technical director Mark Jones, assistant producer Jen Picard, and senior producer Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thanks for joining us.
Come on.
Let's talk about sex, baby.
Musician Utah Phillips is being honored at a folk conference in Rancho Cordova. Next time in Insight, you'll meet this folk legend and storyteller and hear him play live in our studio. Plus, the world premiere of The Peculiar and Sudden Nearness of the Moon. It's playing at the Sacramento Theatre Company. The author and director will tell you all about this play about racial identity, and two actors will perform a scene. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow at 2 on the KXJZ stations.